Hey Builders, this is Rob from Building the Game. I just wanted to check in with you real quick before we start the show and let you know about an event coming up this week, this Friday, November 1st, 2013. Jason and I are going to be hanging out with some good buddies of ours, Steve and Jessica and the crew from Gita Games. You may remember us talking about their game Lily Looking Through. It's a classic style point-and-click adventure puzzle game, and it's being released this coming Friday, the first on Steam and other platforms. As a kind of a celebration of their big event, of this big game release, we're going to be doing a 2-hour long live cast, kind of inspired by what we're doing with the Something from Nothing show. But this is kind of focused strictly on Gita Games and Lily Looking Through, that project. We're going to be hanging out with them. We're going to be talking to those guys about what it's like to bring a video game together from concept to finished product. Talk about a lot of design decisions that have been made. And all kinds of interesting stuff. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Again, it's going to be 2 hours from 8 to 10 p.m. That's Eastern Standard Time this Friday, November 1st, 2013. So check in with us. You can learn more about this by checking out our website, buildingthegamepodcast.com. You can also look out for it on the BTG Co-op site, btgcoop.com. Follow us on Twitter, @podcastbtg. You can also check it out on gitagames.com. That's GEETAGAMES.com. It's me and Jason and the crew from Gita Games. We're going to be talking about their new game, Lily Looking Through. And if you tune in, we're going to be giving away some free Steam codes so you can get a free copy of the game for yourself. So hopefully you'll tune in and hang out with us. We're really, really looking forward to it. It's going to be a great time, and I think we're going to learn a lot just about design process in general. So thanks again, and on with the show. Welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today is Monday, October 28th, 2013, and you are listening to episode 74 of this ridiculous, stupid show that we do every week. Why are you doing that? You should be ashamed of yourself. My name is Rob, and that's Jason. I'm just kidding. You guys are great. Thanks for listening. We appreciate it. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Rob.
How's it going?
Oh, it's just lovely.
That's great. I'm happy to hear that.
It's a lovely day in the neighborhood.
A beautiful day for neighbor?
Yeah, won't you be mine?
No, because we live actually pretty far away from
actually
each other.
Quite a ways.
Opposite sides of the city. In fact, you live in a different city than I do, so you know. Hey.
I literally live two cities away from
you. Two cities away.
Three if you count Schoolcraft.
Yeah, right. And I'm actually north of Kalamazoo. I'm not even in the Kalamazoo city limits, technically. I'm three doors west. Our listeners love this conversation, don't they?
Don't they?
Don't they love this? This is fascinating stuff.
Well, if we have any stalkers out there, it'd be pleased to know that you could start tracking us. Actually, I mean, like, I'm pretty sure they found me already. There's not that many Jason Slingerlands in the United States. Once they find me, they could use Facebook to find your wife, which would allow them to find you.
Right.
Yeah. Stalkers, this is your way to
please
do
don't
this.
Stalk us.
We're not worth stalking.
Right. Remember before Gen Con, we were concerned about people finding our cars and keying our cars in the parking garage?
No, you were concerned about that.
I was concerned about that. Nobody,
I wasn't.
Nobody did that. Thank you. Thank you, listeners, for being nice people and not keying my car.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, what an entertaining show this has turned out to be already.
This is one of our best shows ever.
How's it going?
Oh, it is spectacular.
Good. Good. Well, what's new with you?
Not much. You know,
we... Wow.
This is super interesting.
Great. Thank you so much for that.
What's new with you, Rob?
Learning insight into hot topical discussions and stuff. What's new with me? Not a whole lot either, you know. I'm continuing to work on Troll Cakes. You know what? I should go ahead and announce the official name change for Troll Cakes. because I have.
You should, because inquiring minds want to know.
Yeah, I have officially decided on a name for Troll Cakes. It will no longer be called Troll Cakes. It will not be called Troll House Cookies or Troll House Bakery. As much as I love that name, there are, you know, copyright issues around that, and maybe I don't really have to worry about that. But if I can think of a different name that I like better, why the heck not use it? Right.
That's right.
Plus, you know, I don't want it to just be about cookies or cakes. I want the trolls to be baking all kinds of wonderful, delicious baked goods. And certainly, Troll House Cookies will be one of the menu items, the recipes that you can make in the game. But I want this game to be silly. Anybody who follows me on Twitter has been seeing some of the artwork that I've been doing for the game. And you can see some more of that on the BTG Co-op website. I've posted some of the bug designs up there. And I think by the time this episode posts, I'll put a few more things up. But so that the artwork that I'm doing is kind of silly. The whole idea of the game is kind of silly. So the name that I have decided on, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. I am going to call this the Rumplebum Academy for Bug Based Baking.
I don't like it. I'm just kidding.
Well, you're a jerk.
I've heard it before. I liked it before. I couldn't remember what it was. I just knew it was big, long, and silly.
Yes, it is long and silly. And the idea is that that the players are students who have enrolled at the Rumplebum Academy. And, you know, and there are probably different schools or different... I don't know, different classes or different parts of the Rumplebum Academy. Because the Rumplebum Academy, I think... is an institution created for the betterment of young trolls in the world. And these guys have specifically enrolled in the School for Bug-Based Baking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Mm-hmm. And the Rumplebum Academy, of course, was founded by the great and noble Cordelia Rumplebum, one of the most famous philanthropic trolls of all time.
Well, philanthropic trolls, I mean, that's... There's a long list... Mm-hmm. of competition for that.
Right, but really, I mean, it's hard to argue with Cordelia Rumplebum. I Mr. Dinglefinch, he was also pretty high up in the running, but that's another game.
You need to figure out a way to have Mr. Dinglefinch Mr. be Dinglefinch. Part of this game.
I should. That name just kind of popped out of nowhere. I like it.
Popped out of genius is where it popped out.
I like it. It's fun to think of names for trolls. Once I started trying to think of that, I should make this like a school. I was just like trying to just make up the most ridiculous names I possibly could. Rumplebum ended up being my favorite. And I thought Rumblebum at first, but then that's too many B's. I like that it's Rumplebum.
Rumplebum. It feels very dignified.
I think so.
In a non-dignified way, because the word bum is
kind
in there.
Of ridiculously dignified.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very pleased with that. So the Rumplebum Academy for Bug-Based Baking. Look for that soon. I'm continuing to do the artwork for it. Right now, I've got all the bugs designed. I've got a princess, and I have a knight. And I have started to do the card layout. And by the time this episode airs, I expect to have the card layout finished and hopefully have a logo done as well. So watch out for that, guys. And I will keep on posting pictures of that in progress on the BTG Co-op site.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been doing.
Well, you've also been, and this has been taking up some of my time too, you've also been working on Water Balloon Washout.
That's true too. So right, lots of artwork to do for that.
I think we've mentioned on the show officially that you're doing the layout for that.
I don't remember if we did or not, but just in case you didn't. Hey,
FYI.
I'm doing the graphic design and the layout for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brendan Keough is doing your artwork, and he has been doing a phenomenal, amazing job because he is quite the artist.
He is.
Yeah.
He is. Yeah, but your graphic design has been second to none.
Thank you.
You've done some obviously a lot of layouts, but you've also been... done some like symbols and stuff for the different types of cards, for the water, the utility, and defensive cards, and those have all turned out to be really fun. And
I think this is probably something smart for us to talk about. I guess it's part of game design. It's a little bit more production than design, but I mean it's something that I've started. I think I told you this before. I don't know that I officially said it on the show or not, but I've started to collect cards from different board games?
Yes,
card games?
You did. You mentioned that to me.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I'm not sure if I said
it on the show. I don't think you mentioned
it on the show, though. Yeah, well, the last couple of years of Gen Con, the previous year, and then Gen Con 2013, you get promo cards. People just hand them out of booths and stuff, and I started kind of pocketing them. And I've started to collect more and more example cards promo cards or whatever, just because I think if I'm going to keep doing more of this stuff for me, for you, for, you know, anybody else out there that's interested, I, you know, I'm available for hire. you know, the bigger reference source I have for that, the better. Because I found it very useful so far to look back at other games and see how other things are designed, to kind of take ideas from it, look at what works and what's not so good. And,
right,
you know.
And I think seeing what's not so good is just as helpful as seeing what is good.
Because it's more helpful, really.
You can look at something and go, well, I was thinking about something like that, but that doesn't look like it's going to work. Yeah. So,
and it also,
let me change that.
Yeah, and it also gives me a bigger vocabulary to share with somebody that I'm talking to, like that I've been talking to you about, you know, and trying to make these decisions. I've been saying, hey, do you want it to look more like this kind of game, more like that kind of game? What if we take this feature from that card? It's been very, very helpful.
Right.
So, that's been fun, and for Waterbloom Washout, because it's a fun game for adults, but it's also intended to be playable by kids,
right?
You know, so we made some decisions. We talked a lot about that out, and we want the cards to be very, very clear about what they've got. We want easy color coding to separate the different cards. We want the icons on the cards to be easily identifiable and very, very simple. We want text to be big enough so that you don't have to squint to read it, because again, kids are going to be looking at this, hopefully. We want it kind of whimsical and friendly, without, and we don't want it too over graphic-y.
Right.
You know?
Right. Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the style we kind of ended up with, I did tweet, if you guys haven't noticed it, I tweeted three of the cards, a defense card and a water card and a utility card.
Yeah.
All three, that Rob did the design for, and man, they look fun, you know, and the color coding I think will be really nice, because there's obviously symbols there for the people that just like to have it in the top left corner, but man, the color coding, that was your thought, that makes it so much easier for just like, okay, this and this, you know?
Yeah, and it's also important to remember things like, you know, you and I aren't colorblind, but there are a whole lot of people out there that are colorblind that play games, and so that's why you don't want to just rely on color for a lot of things. You want to make sure you've got symbols and stuff to go along with that to make things like this colorblind friendly. That's really important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, yeah. And I think that I think that we achieved that.
Yeah.
We'll find out, but I think so.
Yeah. So that's been a lot of fun. That's been taking up a lot of my time. So yeah, not really a whole lot of time to play many games. One game that I have been playing recently though is a computer game. It's called The Stanley Parable.
Okay.
And you and I talked about this a little bit offline, and I wanted to bring it up on the show here. Because it's a really kind of unique and different approach to a first-person kind of exploration puzzle game. It's really a hard game to describe. I guess it started out as like a Half-Life mod, it was a mod for any Source Engine game, you know, Valve games, and I guess it was so popular as a free mod to download that the developer decided to just make it a full retail product. And it's Steam now, I think, for $12 or $13, maybe $15. I'm not exactly sure. Anyway, and it's a real small and compact experience, but it's a game that's kind of about challenging some of our expectations of video game design. The best way that I can describe it is to kind of explain a scenario that the game presents to you. Okay, it's about this guy Stanley. You are Stanley, and you're in your office. And one day, suddenly, what you're doing, the work that's stops. Nothing is coming to your computer, so you don't know what to do. And so you get up and you walk out of your office, and the place is empty. Nobody's around. Everybody's gone. And there's a narrator, and the narrator says things like, "Stanley was very confused." So Stanley walked down the hall toward the conference room. And, you know, you can futz around in the office and click on things if you want. There's not really anything to do. Eventually, because there's only the only path presented to you, eventually you have to walk down the hall toward the conference room. But then you get to a big empty room. And you walk into the room, the door closes behind you, because video game. On the other side of the room, there are two open doors. And you walk into the room, and the narrator says, "When presented with the option of two doors, Stanley chose the door on the left." And then the narrator stops. And you're still standing there in that room, and you have to decide if you're going to do what he just told you to do, or if you're going to take the door on the right. And if you take the door on the left, story continues, whatever, no big deal, hey, everything is beautiful. You take the door on the right, and the narrator doesn't really appreciate that. And it's so the, it's a game about kind of calling out those assumptions about video games, mm-hmm. you know, and giving you the opportunity to disagree with the game. So it, you know, it's about the illusion of choice in gaming, right. and really in any kind of a narrative, interactive narrative kind of concept like that. It's a commentary on narration, on storytelling, on all this kind of stuff. It's really, really an interesting experience, and I really enjoyed it a lot. It's kind of a small experience. I mean, like I said, $13-$15. You can probably play the whole game in 2-3 hours, okay. you know, but it's a wonderful and enlightening 2 or 3 hours.
That's cool.
And I highly recommend it. I highly recommend it. Yeah. I could tell you about a bunch of the other scenarios that the game presents, but I don't want to spoil anything for anybody out there listening. If you are interested at all, do yourself a favor and check it out. It's fantastic. It really is something special. And naturally, because this is what we do, got me thinking about board games.
Right.
I thought our feature of the week this week, we should talk about expectations that we have about game design, about board game, card game, tabletop game design. What are some of the core features, components, mechanics, and things that are assumed in any game, and then maybe we can ask the question, is that really necessary?
Okay, so kind of like some generalizations, some assumptions that you make about board games, or games in general, even. I would say a really easy first out of the gate assumption is that they're going to be fun and entertaining, right?
Yeah,
I mean, because mm-hmm. they're games.
Right.
I mean, you could make a game that's purposely not fun,
mm-hmm.
but you're kind of a jerk for doing that,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're selling it to people.
That's a really interesting point, you know, because artwork, let's say, talk in terms of the art world. Art probably was originally created to tell a story, you know. Caveman days, they're drawing things on the wall, they're telling a story. As things evolve, they're trying to present beauty and bring pleasure and joy to people. But at some point, art became challenging and thought provoking, and it's not necessarily there to make you happy. Sometimes it's there to make you unhappy or call your attention.
Yeah.
Uncomfortable, yeah. And so that's an interesting perspective. What if a game exists not to entertain you? We should ask it this way: is there interest in a game that exists to make you ask questions? Or make you uncomfortable?
Well, I think you can have both. I mean, there's this game I've played before called Would You Rather. Have you heard of it before?
Sure.
It's like a party game. I mean,
yeah.
And I played it years ago, but it would present you with terrible situations and then in front of your friends make you say, would you rather? And the group would decide, like everybody would say, I'd rather, you know, one of them I'll never forget was, would you rather swim through 100 yards of a shark tank with raw steaks strapped to your legs, or spend 3 days in blood-covered clothes living in the woods where there were grizzlies?
Well, that's a dumb question because it's obviously the shark tank.
No, I would never take the shark
tank. Why not?
100 yards, you'll be dead in 50.
No, that's nonsense.
No, yeah, they will. They'll eat your face, dude.
No, that's silly.
Raw, bloody steaks attached to your legs.
You could resist a shark attack. You could not resist a grizzly attack.
False. You can climb a tree. The other thing you could do is you could strip naked. I mean, you know, I mean, like, I picked the grizzly attack. In fact...
Well, then you're trying to get around the scenario. I could say, obviously, I can untie the stakes and they'll float away while I swim. But no, I mean, the scenario is this: you either have those bloody clothes on or you have the stakes tied around your legs.
Right.
Huh, yeah. You know, you can't cheat.
I
know you like to cheat.
But we all, except for one person, 3 out of 4, chose the grizzly thing. So, like, I mean, that game is supposed to be, and there were things that, like, I mean, there were things in there, like, would you rather cheat on your spouse or have your spouse cheat on you? I mean, like, they were things to make you uncomfortable, right? I mean, that was the point. But it was also supposed to be entertaining. And, I mean, it was moderately entertaining for a party game. some of the questions like that were a little too, like, kind of like, oh, this is, you know, I mean, let's talk about feelings in an uncomfortable way. But, you know, so that's, but yeah, I guess, you know, I've seen games before that are made to educate.
Yeah.
But they're supposed to be fun. They're not always.
They're supposed to be edutainment.
Edutainment. That's such a good word.
Yeah. Okay, so that's one concept. Then maybe it's not meant to be fun. Maybe it's meant to make you think about something or make you uncomfortable. Okay. What about the concept of having a winner?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to think of a game where there's not a winner, even if the winner is the group. Like in a co-op game, the winner is the group, right?
Yeah.
In a competitive game, or even in a co-op game, the winner, sometimes there may not be a winner because everybody might lose.
Yeah.
But the goal is to have a winner. Mm-hmm. So I would say in storytelling games, there's a good way to challenge that. Storytelling games don't always have a winner. I think of a storytelling game like Tau, right? Like the guys from Sparks Games talk about. Mm-hmm. That has a winner in theory, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, not that it super matters because it's more about the way you get there, like with most storytelling games. But in the end, it's last man standing, right? Yeah. Whereas Fiasco, the winner is kind of the person with the best story, but there's no winner. You know what I mean? There's not supposed to be a winner.
Because Fiasco is not about the end goal. It's about the role playing.
It's about the journey.
Yeah. Yeah, there's another storytelling card game called Once Upon a Time that the winner is the first person to use up all their cards by incorporating those things into the story and reaching their happily ever after card. And that end goal always felt kind of artificial to me when playing that game. That game is basically is the main reason why I don't really care for storytelling games, because I feel like I've never found a game that can get you to that end goal effectively.
And, right.
Yeah.
At least that game does have an end goal with a clear winner.
Right. Yeah. So if there's no winner, can you have a game with no winner? I mean, where the goal of the game is not to win, because you know.
Well, see,
it's either we all win or I win or no one wins.
If your goal in a game, if the goal of the game is to not win, then by not winning, you're the winner. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like if the goal of the game is to be the loser and you're the loser, then really you're the winner.
Well, exactly.
So, I mean, that's just semantics.
Yeah.
You know, I think along the lines of that, you could talk about having a clear end game. Most games, non-storytelling games, have a clear end scenario. What forces this game to end? Sometimes it's multiple things. Sometimes it's not. You know, one of the things we talk about struggling with, especially myself in prototypes, is finding that end game, finding that win condition that says the game's over now. You know, not even talking just about the winner, but just saying the game ends when this happens.
Yeah.
You know, but you expect a published game to have a clear end goal.
Yeah.
I mean, in theory, you expect prototypes of other people's you play to have that too, but that's not always the case. I mean, sometimes it's a worker. I mean, we've done that before. I know we've played my games and I've said, we're just going to play for a while and see what feels like a good end point and then determine what causes that.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that if you're testing.
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah. Gosh, maybe though, if it's going to be a game, there has to be some kind of an end point, but maybe that's some kind of inalienable truth about a game. Well, a game that you expect to have to spend money on in a store, I guess.
I would challenge that with the game Civilization.
Well, that's true.
Did you
I've heard all about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm sure everybody has. There's a dude who's been playing the same
game as Civ 2
for about
like 10 years.
10 years?
Yeah, something like that. And it's still going.
And it's terrible because like everyone has nuked everyone and right. There's, you know, it's kind of like they're like, gosh, is this what real life would end up like eventually?
Mm-hmm.
So,
Civilization is a unique thing. And Civilization gives you kind of a win condition, depending on which version of you're playing. But most versions of the game don't cut you off.
Right.
Yeah.
You could keep playing ad infinitum if you wanted to. Right.
The main Civ games. Like Civ Revolution on the consoles, that won't let you keep going. But the main Civ games on a computer will let you keep going forever in theory.
What about what about some assumptions about types of games? For instance,
okay,
Euros tend to have weak themes and or non-blended, you know, like real blended themes that are just kind of, they don't really matter. They're just tacked on, right? Yeah. Yet when I look at some of the stuff that Dice Hate Me is doing, right? Here's a good way to battle against that. Like some of the stuff they do, you know, feels very Euro with Ameritrash themes put on it. And I mean that as a compliment because I'm a huge fan of Ameritrash themes, you know. I'm thinking of something like Ben Rossett's Brewcrafters, right? Like, I think it says, like, on the little logo thing, it said, like, Euro ingredients, American finish, you know, that sort of thing, right? So, kind of, in general, you'd say that Euros tend to be theme light or theme indifferent, right?
Theme agnostic, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good one. Whereas, you know, like, Ameritrash tends to be really heavy on theme. But I think you look at a company like that and they prove that you can have Euro-style games that have, you know, more American, you know, practicalities.
Yeah. We might be stepping away from the core of this conversation, though.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, because you're talking about, I mean, I'm saying, like, if I sit down and somebody says, oh, I've got this sweet Euro for you to play, I'm going to make some assumptions about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One, it's probably set in the medieval times or the Stone Age or something like that. And, you know, I mean, that, because we're talking about expectations, right?
What about, okay, so other expectations then, if I, we can step on some, into some other ideas.
Sure.
What about, and maybe I'm off base here, what about player choice?
Ah, that's a good one. Because that's kind of become a thing in games, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't always.
Right, it wasn't always. In many, many games from the 80s and 90s, you roll a die and whatever happens, happens.
Right.
You know, and people hate that now. Now right. It's about player choice. Is that really necessary for a game?
You know, I don't remember, it might have been one of the guys from Flip the Table, but somebody I remember was quoted as saying, if it's just a game where you just roll the dice and do what it says, it's an activity. It's not a game.
Yeah, right? Somebody said that to us. I don't remember who that was either, but you're
whoever
right.
Whoever you were, you're smart.
Yeah.
Because that's a good point, right? Right. And I think, personally, that a game needs to have some player choice. You know?
Mm-hmm. So if... But let's say... you know, that's a really hard definition to argue against. Activity, you know,
right?
I'm thinking, you know, player choice. What if the point of the game is not to have fun, but the point of the game is to have some kind of message, like we were just discussing, you know? What if the goal is to get something across to the player, to convey a message? And in that case, then you might be giving the customer, or excuse me, the player, all kinds of illusions of choice, but in reality, the game is structured to get to one specific end goal. And when you get to that end goal, the goal of the designer is to make the player go, oh.
Well, then I think video games do that 95% of the time, right? I mean,
well, they're there to tell a story, and you're just kind of along for the ride.
Right. I mean, yeah. There may be very big choices within the story that may affect the game as an overall.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know, a good example would be Saints Row 3, right? We've talked about that before, where there's, I was talking about the ending I played, and you're like, but you didn't do X. And I was like, well, no, because that wasn't the option. And you're like, well, it was an option. You didn't choose it. So, you know, that's a little more organic, I think. But a lot of video games, yeah, they use a path, and they kind of railroad you on that path. Even if you don't feel like it, even if you feel like you're discovering things on your own, you're really just following their instructions.
Okay. Let's see. Can I tell you about a game idea that I've got? I mean, this is your show to do a game pitch, you know, but since I started thinking about this, this has been bouncing around in my head.
Yeah, go okay. ahead.
All right. So you know that I like weird goals and things, right?
Yes.
You know, like Tyrannosaur Attack. That game was not, it was about messing with people's expectations about a little kid's roll and move board game.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. With the whole thing about, you know, you die and then you become a pan-dimensional time zombie, and you're not, and now you're moving other people's pawns around in the transfer. And eventually, when everybody's dead, you flip the board over, and everybody's back in the game. So it's about kind of messing with expectations about how this game looks from the outset. And I really enjoy those kinds of concepts. And I've got a ways back, I tried to pitch a Bigfoot game, and I kind of failed miserably at it. Because it just wasn't good. And so I was thinking more about this stuff, and every now and then I come back to this Bigfoot idea, and I think, is there something I could do with Bigfoot? And so I had this idea of Bigfoot, a two-player game, Bigfoot versus a hunter, okay? Where the game, it's not a game about rolling dice and playing cards to get things done. It's more like a game of poker where you're playing the other guy. You're not playing the game, you're playing against the other person. And the idea of this, the setup for this, and I'll try and be quick with this. Listeners are going to get a double pitch in this episode. Hey.
That they are.
So it's a two-player game. One player is the hunter looking for evidence, proof that Bigfoot is alive. Bigfoot, the other player is Bigfoot, and Bigfoot's kind of a jerk, and he's just out there teasing the hunter all the time, trying not to get caught, but also trying to get this guy. Okay. So the player who is playing Bigfoot starts the game, and they have a deck of, say, 12 cards, okay? Maybe 15, let's say 15 cards, okay? And so the player has five of those cards are traps, like bear traps. Okay, five of those cards are footprints or evidence that Bigfoot exists, and five of those cards are blank. Okay, and so the Bigfoot starts, and Bigfoot draws four cards. Let's say Bigfoot draws six cards from the deck, and puts down four of those cards face down in a row. All right. And then Bigfoot has two cards left. Okay. Then that's basically the game setup. The hunter, and then Bigfoot places the pawn that represents the hunter on one end of that row of four cards. Okay, because that's just, he has to start at one end or the other.
Yeah, that makes sense. He's entering the arena.
Right. So the hunter now, on his turn, he can do two things. He can move his pawn up to two cards, because these are like spaces on the map, right? So the hunter can move. Can leave his pawn where it is. He can move one space, or he can move two space, one cards. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then hunter then has the option to flip the card that he's standing on. Okay,
right.
If the card that he flips over is evidence, then he basically gets a point.
Right.
Okay. If it's a blank forest floor card with nothing there, oh well, nothing there. If it's a bear trap snaps, and oh, he got Bigfoot got me.
Yep.
Okay. So hunter moves up to two spaces, then flips a card. Then it goes back to Bigfoot. Bigfoot has two cards in his hand, and now every round basically goes the same from here. Bigfoot has two cards in his hand. He has to put one of those cards face down on the table, adjacent to any of the other cards. All right.
That makes sense. Right. Yeah, so he's like expanding the reach of the of
exactly.
The area.
Yeah. And so it doesn't have to be continue in the row. Now he can go orthogonally next to any of those cards, face down. Then he has to draw one more card from the deck, and then Bigfoot has some tokens, and these are bait tokens. And so Bigfoot then places that bait token on any card on the table that is still face down. And basically, what that means is Bigfoot is now shaking a branch out in the woods.
Right.
Right.
Trying to get his attention.
Trying to get the hunter's attention. And that's the end of Bigfoot's turn. And now it's back to the hunter. Now the hunter has more information. And the hunter needs to decide what to do with that information. There's a new card he can explore. There are still three other cards that are still face down that he didn't explore before. And now there's something out there, so there's a shaking branch. He has to decide, based on what the other player just did, what do I do with that information? Is he trying to attract me to a bear trap to hurt me?
Right.
Or is he trying to, you know, freak me out, you know, reverse psychology? Maybe he's shaking a branch over by actual evidence to try and get to scare me away. All right.
Right.
Yeah. So the one thing that the hunter has to do on every turn is he has to flip a card. So I guess he'd have to always move at least one space, come to think of it, because he starts the space on the card that he just flipped. Right.
Now, if the bait card is played, can he automatically just jump to the bait card?
No.
Okay.
No. So that also then says to Bigfoot, what are you going to do? You know?
Right.
So because the hunter might not be able to get all the way to that card. Let's say Bigfoot has two evidence cards in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
he has to put down evidence, you know?
Right.
And so maybe he's got a space where the hunter can't get to it in time, so that's the time that Bigfoot's going to put this stuff down. Hunter then is going to think about that and think, oh, he doesn't want me to go to that one, so I'm going to go to that one.
Right.
You know? So it's about the psychology.
Yeah, yeah.
So the game, and we hear as a game end, the game ends when the hunter either flips three traps. If he has been trapped three times, mm-hmm. then, we should say it this way. The game ends when the third trap is sprung.
Right.
Okay. And then we look at how many pieces of evidence have been revealed. Okay. Right. If there are three pieces of evidence, or I should say, if there are more pieces of evidence face up than face down, the hunter wins.
Right.
If there's more evidence face down than face up, Bigfoot wins.
Right.
And that's one round of the game.
Right.
Okay. Whoever won that round gets a point, gets a cube, whatever, a marker. Then you swap roles. And you do that again, and you play until somebody has 3 points.
Right. And you've told me this before, yeah. Just to be clear.
Right.
The first thing I said was, I love that idea, but you can't have them switch Bigfoot and Hunter halfway during each round of the game. That's, I don't like that.
Why not?
And, no. This is what I said to you. Yeah. And then you were like,
oh, yeah.
Why? And I said, because the expectation is you're going to be playing someone the whole game.
Yeah.
And then we started talking about expectations.
Right.
So, you know, it sounds like a really cool idea. That still bothers me a little, the idea that you swap. Mm-hmm. And the reason it bothers me is because fundamentally, in a game where you're playing a role, like a Phantom of the Opera style game, mm-hmm. I want to be the guy for the whole game.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just because that's what's ingrained in my brain, because that's my expectation. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and in that game like you're talking about, what you're describing works better.
And I think it would, because on that second round, now you're thinking about what you just learned about each other in the last round, and you're going to carry that into the next round, and that's going to influence the decisions you make in that second round of the game, you know?
Right.
Like, you were Bigfoot this time, and you apparently placed your evidence this way, and I'm going to think about how you did that, and I'm going to try and use that information to decide that now that I'm Bigfoot, how am I going to place my evidence to try and trick you?
Right.
So it's not about playing the game and reaching the goal. It's about trying to figure out psychologically what the other guy is thinking.
And by swapping roles, you set some clear expectations about playing each other, because mm-hmm. do I want to follow the strategy you used when you were Bigfoot, or do I want to come up with my own strategy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, no, it's great.
Yeah.
And that's a much better pitch than you did the first time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've had more time to think about it.
It also sounds like a much more fun game.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, this is kind of what I'm thinking about. That when I get excited about challenging what people expect from a game or in a game or about a game, you know, I don't want to just reach the high score. I don't want to, I don't want to have the best hand management of my game. What if there's a completely different way of approaching these same goals?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, it kind of reminds me of the game I pitched, the perpetual drafting game, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's saying, hey, this is how drafting works. And I'm like, actually, let's make the whole game a draft. Let's just, the game is the draft. Sure. You mm-hmm. know, so I think that's, I just popped into my head now that game kind of fits
that's
that.
That's an excellent point. You're right.
Paradigm of different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, paradigm. I always like the word paradigm. Yeah, so what we're talking about is different paradigms in game design.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, listeners, I think we'll probably wrap this discussion now, but I'm interested in having this discussion some more. So mm-hmm. if you have expectations you can think of in gameplay,
mm-hmm.
send them to us. Tweet them at us, email them to us, whatever. If we get a few of those, we'll at least read them on the show, but maybe we'll have another kind of to-be-continued discussion.
Yeah, we can do a follow-up on this.
I just feel like there's a lot that we could talk about that we're not going to, because mm-hmm. we could talk for hours, and I'd really like to hear some other people's thoughts on
it. Yeah, me too.
And then come back to it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that'd be a lot of fun.
Awesome.
Yeah. Okay, we should move on.
Yeah, let's go ahead and roll into practicing the pitch. We've got something special tonight. We decided it would be sweet to do another contest. And so we got a hold of one of our good friends, Mr. Chevy Dodd, mm-hmm. and we asked him if we could do a contest based around his idea for Cardboard Arcade on his game Paper Route. So right now we have Chevy Dodd right on the line here. Hey, Chevy.
How's it going, guys?
It's great. Yeah,
we're great. How are you?
I'm doing excellent.
Fantastic.
Well, first off, I just want to say thank you for being willing to come on the show and be part of this contest.
Yes.
So what we wanted to do for this contest was, and we're going to have Chevy kind of explain to you what the Cardboard Arcade is, and also Paper Route. So it's the system Chevy designed, and we wanted to do a contest to have people try and design a game or a game pitch, at least in that kind of setting or in that kind of the restraints of his idea. So we set out to do that. Chevy said yes, and he also agreed to send the winner, who the three of us will choose, to send that winner a copy of Paper Route, so which is printed by the Game Crafter. So thank you, Chevy, for that. That's very generous of you.
Yeah, no, sounds awesome.
So Chevy, could you give just a short synopsis for us of what kind of Cardboard Arcade is about?
And then- it kind of happened by accident. One of my favorite hobbies is to ask Twitter, like, what should I make a game about and see what happens.
I saw you doing that today.
Yeah, I did it today, actually. I was just kind of sitting at work. And I designed a game today, so hey, that works.
Nice.
And Paper Route happened actually very similar. I told Twitter, like, hey, I'm looking for an idea. And Cyrus Kirby, better known as Father Geek, was like, I've always wanted a game about Paperboy. And I thought, man, that's a really good idea because I loved Paperboy growing up.
And we're talking about Paperboy, the old NES game.
Yeah, the old NES / arcade game. Yeah. And so I thought about it for a little bit, and I immediately had a couple of ideas. And then it was one of those moments where, like, on my car ride home, it just kind of this flood of inspiration hit me. And so I designed the game, and I play tested probably like two different versions. So the version that's available right now is probably like version 3. So it really was a very short production, like development cycle for me. I usually iterate like a bunch of different ideas. But as I was going through it, I realized that this little system that I had created to make this game work as a real-time action-packed card game could work for just about any other, you know, classic video and arcade game. And some other people were like, yeah, I'd really be interested in working on that, working with that. And so I just decided to make it kind of Creative Commons, and let's do it.
No, that's awesome. I think that's such a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so tell us about the Cardboard Arcade system. I mean, what is the structure?
So what it is, the deck of cards is 54 cards, and I chose that on purpose so that, you know, if you wanted to have it done with print-on-demand, that's a standard, you know, print-on-demand quantity of cards to get. Basically, the deck comes with 10 of each directional buttons. So there's 10 up, down, left, and right. And then, what does that leave me with? I'm having 7 14? Of each.
Yeah.
Yes, so 7 of each of the two buttons, A and B. And, you know, I use different colors and stuff to make it not officially NES. But, you know, it is what it is. So sure. You basically have this deck. So in Paper Route, what I did was, I don't know, if you're familiar with Paperboy, there was these houses that you would throw papers at. And while you're doing that, you're traveling down the road at kind of this constant speed. You have to avoid obstacles in your path by moving left or right. You have to, some things you can hit with a paper to get bonus points. And so I wanted to capture that kind of feeling of motion with a card game, which is actually really hard to do.
Yeah.
And so I made it real time, and that really opened it up because now you're competing against another person to do these actions. And so that person's speed in playing the game is the kind of the clock that you're fighting against. And so you're going to set out these houses. So there's house cards, and then there's obstacle cards, and they get paired up. So each house has an obstacle, and those cards have different button icons printed on them. And so the concept is you're flipping over cards from the top of your deck, and you're trying to match the set of buttons that are required by that house and obstacle. And if you can complete that set, then you can score that, meaning that your opponent can't. And so you're kind of in this mad rush trying to score these 5 sets of cards before your opponents can. And so that's it. That's basically it. You know, you're just going to flip over cards as fast as you possibly can and try to match these buttons. If you screw up, you lose a life. And, you know, you have 3 lives. And if you lose all your lives, the game's over.
Yeah, and what's cool about that is that you didn't just try and reproduce the game. You focused on recreating some of the exhilaration and excitement of playing the game.
Yeah, I wanted that experience. That game was so frustrating. Like,
yeah.
You know, everybody, you know, you could play it for a few hours and suddenly getting past day one was really easy. But then the game ramps up and you're like, oh my God, I can't do this. And so I really wanted to capture that panic of just mashing buttons. And that was what I tried to do. And so that was the original intent of the system of the Cardboard Arcade. But what the Cardboard Arcade doesn't have to be a real-time two-player card game. Like, you could use that deck of cards to do anything. The concept was I wanted there to be a common deck of cards for each player. So I made, like, four different colors. You use player one through player four. And if you own all four of those sets, it should be easy to just put those into another game. So we don't have to keep recreating those components. As a print and play or print-on-demand player, I love being able to reuse components. So if I had two decks of cards that I can use for 10 different games, that's much more enjoyable than me making 10 different new decks of cards every time. So the Cardboard Arcade, the system isn't really a system as so much as it just defines the deck of cards so that all games that use the Cardboard Arcade use the same cards.
Sure.
And then, you know, like with Paper Route, I think there's 10 houses and like 14 or so obstacle cards. So there's just 24 extra cards on top of the two Cardboard Arcade decks, and you can play Paper Route. So, you know, I have a few other design ideas to use the system as like a hand management type thing. Like I had a fighting game that I was working on where you would just have a hand of cards and you're trying to make combos, you know, stuff like that too. So,
yeah, that's cool. It's a great system or a great kind of framework to put something together in. It's so simple. It's kind of exciting. It's one of the things that made us, well, it's mainly the main thing that made us want to kind of do this contest, because we thought it was such a simple and versatile way to kind of conceptualize a game that we wanted to encourage people to try and do that.
Yeah.
And no, it's awesome. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And to help encourage people to do that, Rob and I, over this episode and the next,
yep,
are each going to pitch a game in the Cardboard Arcade, you know, using those player decks, and adding them to it, both recreating classic NES games, because that sounded awesome to us, you know. So yeah, I'm gonna do this one. I'm gonna pitch on this episode, and Chevy's here, so Chevy's gonna kind of give us some feedback and tell us how you listeners could do way better than we did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so listeners, what, just before we forget, what you're gonna need to do is, you're gonna want to send us an email at buildingthegamepodcast.com,
mm-hmm,
with
buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com.
@gmail.com, or you could just go to our website and then go to send us an email.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. So buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com. You'll send us an email with the game you're trying to emulate and just kind of a brief pitch of, you know, what type of cards you'd include and how it would work. You don't have to go super detailed, because it's an email. Yeah. So, and then we'll talk about all those on the show. So,
yeah.
And we'll talk about all of them. And Chevy and us, we'll look at them together as well. So,
mm-hmm.
All right.
So what do you got, Jason? Pitch us something.
So, and we purposely did not tell Chevy ahead of time which games we were going to be pitching.
Right.
So Chevy, I don't know if you've heard of this game or not, but the game I'm going to be trying to emulate with the Cardboard Arcade is Gunsmoke.
Okay.
Which is titled Gun Period Smoke. I have a feeling they did that to get around some licensing issues, because the game, sure, has nothing to do with Gunsmoke. The game, you are a cowboy and you're like a bounty hunter, I believe, and you're just walking through this town. It's like almost like a rail shooter, basically. It's like top down. You're just moving forward, and bad guys are coming out, and you're trying to shoot them. And at the end of each level, you get to a boss. And you kill the boss, and you get the bounty, and then you move on. Throughout the game, you're shooting barrels, and the barrels will give you power-ups. The power-ups can be boots, which make you faster, and you can keep getting more, guns, which make you shoot farther, and bullets, which make your bullets do more damage when they hit. Also, you can get Fred the Horse. His name's not actually Fred. That's just what Robbie's calling me as a kid.
I used to call him Fred, yeah.
And the horse is like the best thing in the game ever, because it's a one-hit kill game. If you get hit, you're dead. So the horse makes it harder to kill you. So, yeah, that's the game I want to emulate here. I'm calling it Guns, Period, Blazing. And
nice.
Thanks. I wanted to put that period in there because I thought that was just kind of silly.
Yeah, it's a little nod to it, right?
Right. And the original concept of this game, I actually talked through this game quite a bit with Rob ahead of time. And the original concept was each player would be controlling a bounty hunter who'd be moving through the board at the same time. And you'd be competing, trying to kill bad guys. And that means the bad guys are kind of AI, which was kind of dull. So Rob suggested, why not have one person play the good guy who's stronger and has more abilities, and one person play the bad guy who has a horde of people. Sure. And I really liked that idea.
What can I say? I'm a genius.
You are sometimes.
Yeah, I like asymmetrical play.
Yeah. Right. And this, yeah, this is quintessential asymmetrical play. Now, I included a board with mine because I could not think of a better way to do it. So it's an 18 by 18 board that's laid out like a Western town, much like the game is, with squares on it. You have a token for your bounty hunter, and then more tokens are put on the board. There's tokens for barrels, and there's also tokens for bad guys. So each turn, bad guy, or the player playing the evil people, I hate to call him a bad guy, it seems unfair, but he's a bad guy.
Mm-hmm. So, the villain.
I just picture that would be Rob. The villain will draw four cards, two from the barrel pile, and two from the barrel pile and two from the bad guy pile, right? Which are like random bad guys, different types. Sometimes they're evil cowboys, other times they're really mad Indians who want to scalp you or something. I don't know. So that's what it is in the game, at least. And yeah. So what they'll do is they'll look at those four cards, they'll lay down the two bad guy cards, and they'll place those two bad guys wherever they want, in, you know, like a set area. And then for the barrels, there would be spots marked on the board where the barrels could go. So what's happening is when the villain is looking, that player two is looking at the those cards, they know what... you know, they know what's in the barrels. Player one does not know that. So they're going to do based on what's in the barrels. They're going to put the barrels in the spot they choose. Does that make sense? So there's like six options, sure, say, on the board. So you could try to fake somebody out by putting good stuff towards the back of the board. Or maybe you know what I mean? So that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, both players are going to have their decks of their decks of cards they're going to use. Does that make the player decks?
Yes.
So, they've got their player decks. The good guy, the player one, is always going to act first. Now, the player one, he can play three player cards. He can play three player cards on a turn. He can also... he can play three player cards, and he can A and B automatically shoot five squares out in either orthogonal directions, because that's how the game worked. Player two is only allowed to play two cards, and they can only shoot three squares out. So player two is handicapped from the beginning because they always are going to have extra people in play. So what's going to happen is you're going to take turns playing back and forth, trying to shoot each other. Player one can shoot a barrel and step on a barrel, and as soon as they do that, they're going to get that power-up that was there. And the power-up could be, you know, any number of things, much like the video game. Could be boots, could be a horse, it could be the POW cube, which is always my favorite, that clears the screen completely. Or it could just be junk. All right, so does that make sense so far?
Yeah.
Making sense? Cool. So,
definitely.
So you play five rounds like that, and then the boss comes out. And the bosses in this game always crack me up, because, like, they would have these weird names, like... what it shows you is it shows you their wanted poster, and like the guy's name is Cutter. In fact, that's one of them, and his weapon is Boomerang. But when I was a kid, I would read it and I swore the guy's name was Cutter Boomerang, which I was like, that's the weirdest name ever, and he just happens to have a boomerang. That's so weird. And then there is Ninja Darts, but he's actually a ninja who uses darts. So, I mean, I thought that, not that I thought that just when I was a kid, I thought that until last week when I downloaded the game for PlayStation, cause they have the original game on there. Cause I wanted to play it again to kind of get a feeling for it. And then it finally clicked. Like, I was writing their names down. I'm like, wow, this guy's last name is Winchester. That's so silly. And then I was like, oh gosh, you idiot. These are actually their weapon. Wow. That's dumb. But, anyway,
I played a lot of Paperboy while I was making paper rounds. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's so easy to draw inspiration that way. It's just great. So then the bosses each have their own unique abilities. I'm thinking you play three rounds, like, so you'd play 15 rounds total. So basically you play through three bosses. If the player one is still alive at the end of that, he wins. If he dies before then, he loses.
Nice.
So yeah, that's kind of look at my notes here. I don't think I missed anything. I feel like the idea is that it'll work a lot like the game. The balancing is obviously a big deal. Like figuring out how many lives to give the player one, because that's kind of going to be your main balancing factor, is how many lives does player one get? And in the game, you can actually adjust it. Normally, you get three, but you can have up to like seven. Instead of giving him hit points, I really want to give him lives, because that's a little more true to the game. But in addition to that, then anytime you die, you lose one of your bonus cards that you've gotten from barrels. So, you know, that way dying has a penalty, but you're still in the game.
Right.
So, yeah. So there's my pitch.
I like it. I think it sounds fun. The barrel placing sounds really, really neat. I kind of like the idea that you know, like, especially if you could bring out the dudes kind of in a restricted zone, but the barrels can be kind of anywhere. It gives you a lot of freedom to kind of hide things or be tricky. I like that.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, I like it too. Yeah. And so in component wise, so you're using two of the standard cardboard arcade decks, right?
Yep. One for each player.
Right. And then you're adding a deck of bad guys, a deck of barrels, and a small deck of bosses, or just, oh no, just one boss.
No, there would be three bosses.
There'd be three bosses. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Okay.
And then the game board and some tokens.
Yep. And for bad guys, there might be 10 bad guys, and you just would shuffle them up, mm-hmm. you know?
Right. That'd be cool.
And then you'd need two barrel tokens, mm-hmm. two bad guy tokens, and then because the cards would be laid out, so, you know, it really wouldn't matter. And I would probably say just make them color coded, like, you know, one, like, two of the cards so that it wasn't confusing.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah, it really bums me out that you have to use a board, but I just don't see a way around that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see a problem with it, though. Like,
I mean, I think the cool thing about, like, one of the things I had mentioned to Robin as I with this was finding, like, the smallest board the GameCrafter had and using that. Because the squares can be really small if you're just using little widgets to be your guys.
Right.
The nice thing is, because that background is such a big deal as part of the game, it would be kind of cool, mm-hmm. you know, for that to be kind of part of it. So
yeah, definitely. And,
you know, you could also have, because in the game there's different ways the guys spawn. Like the rifleman can spawn in windows. So, like, you could actually have squares that were like a window, and if it's a rifleman, you have the option that, you know, the if I'm the mm-hmm. opponent, I can put him up there, so he can't move, but he's also harder to hit. You know, so
yeah.
So yeah,
that's awesome.
I think there's a lot to begin with it. As this was a really fun exercise in kind of designing with constraints, yet it felt very freeing because there was such an awesome thing, you know, between the game, like just the Gunsmoke game, me liking it so much and getting so much inspiration from it, and then the limitations of the cardboard arcade really didn't feel like limitations. It kind of felt like, hey, somebody designed half these rules for me.
Yeah, I, you know, like I said, I have some ideas that I need to pursue. And I think that what really excites me about this contest is I wanted to show different ways of using the decks of cards, but I just never got around to doing it. So letting other people kind of help me show that is really exciting. I think you've got a really unique way of going about it.
Yeah, and hopefully everybody out there who's listening right now will try and come up with their own ideas. You know, of course, there's no obligation for you to see your idea through, but we would more than encourage that. I mean, GameCrafter makes it so easy for you to... I feel like this is one big sales pitch for GameCrafter.
Yeah, well, you know, it can be. In fact, like, so Paper Route is going through a bit of a repackaging and a slight little... uptick in design right now, so hopefully by the time people are listening to this, I'll have that done.
Cool.
But I think if you go on my website right now and click on the Cardboard Arcade link, I have links purchasing decks, but I think they're currently through ArtsCal.
Okay.
And I've never actually gone about setting them up on the GameCrafter, so I should probably do that.
That's probably a good idea.
But it's all print on. It's all print yeah. and play right now. You can download everything and play the game for free. You right. know, play paper. Play. You can play Paper Route for free. You can download the Cardboard Arcade decks for free. Mm-hmm. All the rules and stuff are available on my website.
So. Yeah, so make sure to go to ChevyDodd.com. I'll mm-hmm. link to it in the show notes, but yep. it's easier for you just to go to ChevyDodd.com, which it's ChevyDodd.com.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a good website, too.
Yeah.
Click on the Cardboard Arcade link at the top.
Yeah, so guys, our end date for this contest is November 30th, the last day of November. So get your submissions in to buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com. Send us your game pitch. Tell us how you would like to use the Cardboard Arcade idea. What classic video game would you translate, and how would you do that using this fantastic system? November 30th is your cutoff. Get it into us, and we'll review everything, and we will announce a winner in December. So that's what we got.
Sweet.
Yeah. Thanks, Chevy. We really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, thanks for doing this.
And we'll check back in with you again next week when it'll be my turn to pitch a game, okay?
Awesome.
Cool.
Can't wait.
Yeah, me too. It's exciting. Okay, moving on then, huh?
Yep.
Okay, and I think that's going to wrap us up. Oh, no, we have some comments and some questions here. So let me hit up a couple of those. First of all, I have two things from Scott King.
Scott King.
Yeah, he had gotten in touch with us on Twitter. First, he had commented on last week's episode where we were talking about feedback and about giving and getting good feedback. On that subject, Scott says, I teach my writing students that getting good feedback is about asking the right questions. And I think that's excellent advice.
Words of wisdom right there. No, yeah. I think that's really good. Mm-hmm. And that's something we didn't really talk that much about.
No.
But you do, I mean, you need to, sometimes people have trouble giving feedback just because they're nervous. And sometimes just talking to them, you can get their feedback without them even feeling like they're really giving mm-hmm. you feedback. So
yeah. Yeah. So don't underestimate the need for you as the designer to ask the right questions. So
and
that's
I think,
very important.
You know, something you can use for that, for designing or writing, as Scott was saying,
yeah.
Is kind of make a list ahead of time for yourself of the things mm-hmm. you want answered about your game. I know that that's something I a lot of times do. I have a checklist in my head. You know, like, so I'll say, what did you think about this aspect of the game?
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. So thank you, Scott.
Yep. And he had a question for us. He says, how many games do you guys have currently in progress, and how do you handle bouncing back and forth between them?
First short answer would be too many and not very well.
Yeah.
I think at any given time, because of the show, I would say the minimum any of us are working on is probably three. Like three isn't to yeah. say in the pitch stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for prototyping stage, I mean, it just depends on how expansive you want to be with that. I mean, I think right now I have probably 10 prototypes, but I'm only actively testing a few of those. But you know, that said, I have a backlog of prototypes that I want to get out there to get tested.
Yeah, I mean, you can go back over our you know, close to year and a half of shows, and you can listen to all those pitches, and any one of those at any given time, or for me anyway, any one of those at any given time, I might be thinking about again. I was just thinking back to Slenderman stuff that I talked about a year ago, you know, just today, and things just keep coming back to me. But active development, actively occupying my brain, yeah, probably three or four at any given time. And then as far as picking what to focus on, it, you know, giving myself a deadline helps me a lot. Like as we got closer to Gen Con this year, I decided that Frankenstein's Legacy kind of had the most potential, mm-hmm. and so I focused on that, and then I got to be a finalist in the Cards Against Humanity Deathmatch contest, which meant, oh gosh, now I've got to get Rocket Wreckers right. ready
which
too.
Which decided for you.
Which you decided
You'll
for
be
me,
focusing
right.
on Rocket Wreckers.
Right. Sometimes those deadlines are imposed upon you, whether you like it or not. And then lately, you know, I decided to just, I saw that Game Crafter contest about a mini game contest, yep. and I thought, well, gosh, what do I have kind of in my brain right now that might work for that? And that's what got me going on Troll Cakes the Rumplebum Academy for bug-based baking.
Right.
You know, so I kind of look for little goals like that, or little deadlines that I can give myself to try and help me focus, because without that, I can't really focus.
Right. And it's funny too how you say like old things come back. I mean, we were just talking at work today how I was going through my old emails mm-hmm. and I came across my pitch notes for Grandma's Goat.
Yeah, right.
Which was a game that I kind of just disregarded in favor of doing the Explorer style game. And when I was reading back through my notes, I had this kind of flood of inspiration. Like, I kind of feel like Grandma's Goat is the better game out of those two things, you know, and that, you know, that's kind of, that's funny how that happens, you know, and it's like not something that I'm going to drop everything to work on, but it's one of those, like, add that to the list of games that I would like to prototype at some point, you know?
Yep. And just at lunch today, you and I were talking back when we had Danny Devine on the show. About some of the evolution concepts that we talked about with him.
Yeah, with like the Punnett squares.
Right. And that got me thinking microbes and you know, unit combat and stuff. Like, I don't know. Anyway, and I tweeted some about that today when we're recording this. Again, if you follow me on Twitter, you would have seen some of that. So, you know, these things are always kind of resonating in our heads, and it can sometimes be a struggle to get them out of our heads so that we can focus on one project.
And, you know, I think one of the things is nice that because we have so many things bouncing around in our heads and we're just kind of like that, mm-hmm. I think a lot of designers are like that, but the show works as a pretty good outlet for that.
It sure does.
To kind of force us to put a simple pitch together, mm-hmm. push it out there, have it documented, know that we can always go back. Like today, you went back and listened to the Slender Man episode because you wanted to remind yourself of what that pitch was about.
What was that all about, right?
So, I mean, the curse of that is, you know, you could say we're forced to come up with new ideas, but there have been a few episodes where it's been like, hey, I'm really trying to struggle with what to pitch this time. Mm-hmm. That does not happen very often.
Not as often as I expected it to.
Got a couple of pitches, you know, lined up here.
Right.
So. Cool.
Yeah, so many that I managed to shoehorn an extra one into this episode for me.
You did.
Okay, and then we have a couple of extra comments or questions here from John Coview on Twitter. He says, how does one go about hiring a graphic designer? He's interested in the pros or cons of contract versus passion project, pros and cons of pay per piece versus pay per project, versus giving a percent of Kickstarter funds or other hiring options or ideas that we might have. You know, this is a little bit of a tougher subject for us.
Yeah, I mean, the best I can talk about here is...
Yeah, because you've hired an artist for full projects now.
Right, and graphic designer. But so, you know, I've worked with different artists or talked to a lot of different artists. I primarily worked with the same one, which is Brendan, just because he does a good job and we work very well together. He takes feedback very well. He understands what I'm trying to say when I give feedback, and also the way that I give art references works pretty well for him as well. But I pay him on a per piece basis. Now, that said, you know, I'm thinking about the whole cost of the package, and usually we'll settle on that ahead of time, but it's based on a per thing fee. You know, and he's good about scaling based on complexity for one piece. One piece might cost more than another because it's going to take him, you know, a couple hours compared to 6 hours, depending if it's a bigger piece. For graphic design with you, we agreed on a price for a project. We said, this is probably how much time it would take. This seems like a fair price, you know, and it helps because, you know, knowing you, it's pretty easy to talk about that. You know, and with Brendan, at first, you know, it was a little nerve wracking to have to say, all right, you know, what do you want to charge? But because he's a pro, he gave me a price. I've had other artists that have come back with prices and I just couldn't afford them. And
yeah,
you know, that's totally cool.
It's going to happen. Yeah.
You know, that's not on them. That's not on me. It's, we were just too far apart on pricing, you know, and that certainly doesn't take anything away from the artist, or I hope not from me.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's,
yeah,
I think, you know, the whole passion project idea, I assume what you mean by that is they're working for free as part of the project. Man, you know, that's really up to the person. If they're doing it for a living, it's going to be hard pressed to find, you know, where somebody like Rob, you know, I mean, your passion projects are the things you do graphic design for yourself and mm-hmm. art for yourself, games you're designing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. It's tough. So pay per piece or pay per project. That's difficult for me to comment on because I've hired two artists to do two pieces of artwork each. You know, Johnny did a couple things for me for Frankenstein, and Danny did a couple things for me for Rocket Records. And that's the only thing I've ever paid anybody to do, and I was thrilled with both end results. You know, and so far neither of them has expanded beyond that, so I haven't gone back to those guys to talk again about whole project pricing. And now in terms of paying from the Kickstarter funds, that's, you know, I've never been in that position before. You had already priced out with Brendan on a per piece basis,
right?
But of course, your plan was to you weren't going to pay for all the artwork until you had the Kickstarter funds,
right?
And if I were doing the same thing, I was doing my own Kickstarter, I would have to do the same thing. You know, right. I would need to raise the money before I could pay for the artwork,
which we've said unfortunately can be a real tough thing.
It can.
Now it's
different
for you because you do graphic design and layout, so you have a couple pieces of artwork. You can transform that into what looks like a pretty complete game, you know. I mean,
yeah, to some degree,
within the bounds of reality, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's, you know, one thing I would caution with, and this is something I wasn't worried about with you because we know each other so well. But if you're going to do it on a contract, like okay, I'm going to charge you X amount for this project, make sure the expectations are clear of what you expect. And even you and I did this. I mean, I said,
yeah,
we need to revamp the logo, we need to do the layout, we need to do some design work,
right?
But you want to make that clear because you, first of all, want to make sure they're pricing based on what you need.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, you know, for getting timing done and getting it done on time. And then third, you don't want in the end to have them come back and say, well, listen, I thought you needed this and you actually needed that, so I'm going to need to charge you more, you know, because it's fair. That can still put you in a tough position. So I think.
Yeah.
With our limited knowledge, best advice we can give you.
Right.
It's a great question, though.
Yeah. Give your artist and your designers both, if the same person or if it's two different people, give them both very clear written instructions on what your expectations are. Give them what you want for a deadline and then ask the question if they can meet that deadline or what it's going to cost to meet that deadline and work it out from there.
And ask, too, for an artist especially, ask about revisions.
Yeah.
What's built in, you know? With Brendan, I know I'm going to get a couple of revisions as part of the package.
Yeah.
You know, because he knows that I'm not always going to ask for revisions. Sometimes I just see what he did and I'm like, perfect. Don't change anything, you know? And other times I might say, let's tweak this and this, you know?
Mm-hmm. But of course, we're still newbies at all this stuff,
right.
You know?
You know, one artist that I had contacted before who I didn't end up using, they gave me a really detailed layout of you get unlimited revisions in phase one. This many hours in phase two, this much in phase three. So, you know, yeah.
Yep.
So I think that's all of our questions then.
I think that is all we've got then. So
sweet.
Thank you, John and Scott, for writing in. We appreciate that.
Yeah, good questions. Thank you.
And thank you to everyone out there for listening to the show. We really appreciate it. If you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email to buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @podcastbtg. Jason is @JASlingerland, and I am @poorly_designed. You can like us on Facebook, and you can give us a 5-star review on iTunes, and you can make sure to check out Something from Nothing, our bi-weekly video Google Plus Hangout designer talk thing that we do every 2 weeks on Sunday nights at 8:00 Eastern time. It's super fun.
Yep.
Check it out. And you can come on back every week and hang out with us and listen to us ramble on about stuff that hopefully you find entertaining.
That's right.
A little secret here. Chevy's going to be back next week. So, if you don't like us, he's great. So you can listen to him.
Yeah. So at least listen to the next
episode. That's a good reason to listen to next week's show. All right. Thanks again, guys. Bye-bye. Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios.
All the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are the property of the Building the Game podcast.
Next time on Building the Game. That's very cool. That's very cool. That's very cool.
It's super cool. Hey.